Late that night, Concepcion drifted mysteriously across the harbor. Because no one knew of Magellan's subterfuge, she appeared to be dragging her anchor. It was only a matter of time before she came within range of the flagship and touched off a battle at sea. Aboard Concepcion, the rebellion was beginning to falter. Ginés de Mafra, held hostage along with Mezquita, noticed that Quesada, the leader of the mutiny, was experiencing pangs of remorse, but he could not persuade his followers to end their rebellion now. Quesada's only hope, a faint one, was to slip past the blockade and escape. De Mafra wrote, "He gave the order to weigh anchor, but this did not turn out well for him as the current brought his ship down the river to the flagship." Quesada patrolled the quarterdeck, bearing sword and shield, hoping to regain control of the ship, or, failing that, to slip past Magellan unnoticed. Instead, he sailed straight into a trap. As Concepcion approached the flagship, Magellan shouted, "Treason! Treason!" and ordered his men to ready their weapons. Suddenly, Trinidad opened fire on the approaching vessel, hurling cannonballs onto her decks. Before Quesada's men could offer resistance, Trinidad's loyal seamen grappled Concepcion to her side and rushed aboard as Victoria performed the same maneuver on the hapless ship's starboard side. "Who are you for?" the attackers cried as they swarmed across Concepcion's cramped decks. "For the king," came the response, "and Magellan." The mutineers' about-face may have saved their lives because Magellan's guard made straight for Quesada and his inner circle, who offered little resistance. The guard freed Mezquita, the deposed captain, along with Ginés de Mafra. The coup was generally bloodless. With Quesada and his inner circle under arrest, and Concepcion returned to Magellan's control, the mutiny of Port St. Julian came to an ignominious conclusion. Even Juan de Cartagena, aboard San Antonio, gave up hope of carrying out a mutiny. When Magellan demanded Cartagena's immediate surrender, the rebellious Castilian meekly complied and was confined in irons in Trinidad's hold. Now that the Easter Mutiny was finally at an end, Magellan meted out punishment to the guilty parties. The mutineers were about to discover that defying Magellan was even more perilous than the most ferocious storm at sea. To begin, Magellan instructed one of his men to read an indictment of Mendoza as a traitor. The captain general then ordered his men to draw and quarter Mendoza's body. Magellan directed that the quartered remains be spitted and displayed as a warning of exactly how traitors would be treated. The preserved body parts of Luis de Mendoza remained visible throughout the next several months in Port St. Julian, an indelible lesson to the men concerning the consequences of mutiny. Magellan's display of barbarism did not end there. He was only beginning to exact revenge for the mutineers' insult to his authority and to the honor of King Charles. More than execution, torture was his ultimate weapon at sea. That he resorted to torture was not unusual. This was, after all, the era of the Spanish Inquisition. To punish the other offenders, Magellan conducted a secular inquisition at Port St. Julian. He appointed his cousin, Alvaro de Mezquita, as judge, presiding over an exhaustive trial. First, Magellan had promoted him to captain of San Antonio over the heads of more qualified pilots and master seamen, both Spanish and Portuguese. Now Mezquita functioned as Magellan's agent of agony, deciding who was guilty of treason and who would suffer the consequences. No wonder the men hated him. Mezquita spent 2 weeks assessing the evidence of guilt. He let one of the accused off with a slap on the wrist. The accountant, Antonio de Coca, was merely deprived of his rank. But Mezquita found Andres de San Martin, the esteemed astronomer-astrologer, Hernando Morales, a pilot, and a priest, all guilty of treasonous behavior. Mezquita ordered San Martin to undergo the most common punishment of the Inquisition, the ghastly strapado. The strapado was administered in 5 stages of increasing agony. In the first degree, the victim was stripped. His wrists were bound behind his back, and he was threatened until he confessed. If he refused, he was subjected to the second degree. In it, The victim's arms were raised behind his back by a rope attached to a pulley secured overhead, and he was lifted off his feet for a brief period of time and given another chance to confess. If he still refused, he faced the third degree of the strappado, in which he was suspended for a longer period of time, which dislocated his shoulders and broke his arms. If he still failed to confess, he was subjected to the fourth degree. The victim was suspended and violently jerked, which inflicted excruciating pain. In certain cases, there was a fifth degree as well. In the final phase of the strappado, weights were attached to the victim's feet, and they were often heavy enough to tear the limbs from his tormented body. Andres de San Martin suffered the full five stages of the strappado. In the last, most horrific stage of Magellan's Inquisition, several cannonballs were attached to San Martin's feet, and the additional weight inflicted awful pain when he was suspended. San Martin survived the ordeal. In fact, he recovered sufficiently to return to his former position as an astronomer and astrologer. But from then on, he remained wary of Magellan and the entire enterprise of the Armada. The punishment Mezquita and Magellan inflicted on Hernando Morales was even more severe than San Martin's. Accounts of the proceedings say only that Morales's limbs were disjointed. But the procedure to which he was subjected was so severe that the poor pilot later died from the wounds he received. The agonies he suffered at the hands of Mezquita and Magellan can only be imagined. Once the horror of this inquisitional catharsis subsided, Mezquita, with Magellan's blessing, sentenced the other accused in all 40 men to death. A mass execution appeared to be in the making, but the expedition could not continue without the help of the convicted men. Believing that he had finally demonstrated his absolute authority, Magellan commuted all 40 of the death sentences to hard labor. There were two important exceptions to the general clemency. Gaspar de Quesada, the leader and murderer of San Antonio's master, and his servant, Luis de Molino. Magellan insisted that Quesada be executed, and he gave Molino a brutally simple choice. He could either be executed along with his master or spare his own life by beheading his master. Molina accepted the deal, as cruel as it was. In full view of the crew, Quesada knelt on the deck of Trinidad, and Molino stood over him, sword in hand. He asked his master for forgiveness, but received none. And then with one powerful blow, he severed Quesada's head from his neck. Days later, Magellan discovered that Cartagena, the sole surviving Spanish captain, was conspiring with a priest, Pero Sanchez de la Reina, to mount yet another mutiny. It was astonishing that Magellan's nemesis would risk his life again, after all the carnage, this time with little hope that any of the seamen would follow, but Cartagena was almost as stubborn as Magellan. The captain general subjected the two conspirators to a fresh court-martial. His first instinct was to have both men executed. This was, after all, Cartagena's third attempt at mutiny. But Magellan found himself in a difficult position. He could not bring himself to condemn a priest, even a disloyal priest, to death. And as for Cartagena, his blood ties to Archbishop Fonseca prevented Magellan from taking severe disciplinary action, such as execution or torture. Instead, Magellan devised a much worse fate for Cartagena and the priest. He decided to leave them behind to fend for themselves in the wilderness of Port St. Julian after the fleet's departure. Always a perfectionist about outfitting his ships, Magellan turned his attention to his neglected fleet. The ships were in a state of disrepair, their sails and rigging in disarray, their holds fetid, their hulls leaky. He ordered his men to empty the ships and give them a thorough cleaning. This exhausting chore meant removing all the provisions, even the stone ballast, which was cleansed by seawater. Once they had emptied the ships, the seamen scoured the holds, washed down the wooden surfaces with vinegar to eradicate the ubiquitous stench, and returned the ballast to the ships. So the wretched winter passed, day by day, hour by hour, the men working constantly and trying to keep themselves warm as best they could, enduring life in a prison so remote it needed no walls. Overseeing these projects, Magellan intended to keep his prisoners in chains until they left Port St. Julian in the spring. When the time came to load the provisions, they discovered more evidence that the dishonest chandlers in Seville and the Canary Islands had robbed them blind and endangered their lives. Although their bills of lading showed enough supplies on board to last a year and a half, long enough to reach the Spice Islands, the ship's holds actually carried only a third of that amount. Magellan realized that they would likely run out of food well before they reached their goal. To make up the difference, the men resumed hunting, but they were eating their way through their supplies almost as fast as they replenished them. The only way out of their predicament was to resume the voyage as soon as possible, storms or no storms.